Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did we make it through the Cold War without resorting to mutually assured destruction? Throughout the Second World War, many of our most powerful blows against our enemies were delivered by airplane. Although the tactic had served us well, bombers had limits in terms of their range and their speed, and they could be shot down before reaching their intended targets. Those realities convinced General Bernard Schriever that the U.S. needed to invest in intercontinental ballistic missiles, which, with their terrifying speed and devastating warheads, would leave our enemies little doubt that any strike on U.S. targets could be met with swift and massive retaliatory force. A new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Neil Sheehan tells Schriever's story. It's called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Schriever and the Ultimate Weapon. Neil, welcome to Think. In some ways, this really boils down to a story of how smart people save the world. Will you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's because it's true. What happened was people like to think of the Cold War as one long ice age, but it wasn't. Back in the 1950s, in the early years, it was a very warm confrontation. In a very unstable situation in which both sides were jockeying for power. And if we could very easily have had a nuclear confrontation, a nuclear war. And what Bernard Schriever and those who worked with him accomplished was, and without their work, you and I might not be talking here today. We might be irradiated dust. What they accomplished was to create a nuclear stalemate with the intercontinental ballistic missile, in which neither side could wipe out the other and escape destruction itself. And therefore, they achieved stability and bought peace, during which you gain time for the Soviet Union to collapse of its own inner contradictions, which it finally did.
General Schriever was on the cover of Time magazine in 1957, but he hasn't really been a household word for decades. Can you talk about how his story struck you as a good lens through which to view our strategy in the Cold War?
Yes. He was very famous within the Air Force, excuse me,
sure,
but not outside of it. I'm sorry, something caught my throat. What happened was someone suggested to me that I ought to write a book about the arms race in the Cold War. And I said, that's an awfully diffuse subject. You know, I write books with narratives that readers want to read. I don't write academic treatises. And I said, well, why don't you look into the career of Bernard Schriever? And I was over in the Air Force Association Library in Arlington across the river from Washington. And they keep files on major figures in the Air Force. And I asked for the file on General Schriever. And I looked at it, and the first thing I saw when I opened it was a photograph of this very handsome man in uniform leaning up against the table, surrounded by the models of all these missiles he'd built. And I thought, man does look interesting. So I looked him up in the phone book and rang him up. He turned out to be living 8 blocks from where I live in Washington. And he said, well, come over and see me on Saturday morning, and I'll talk to you. So we talked. And it was the first of 52 interviews with him. It became clear to me, after doing a bit more research and the first few interviews with him, that Bernard Schriever was a lens through whom I could tell the story of this unoverlooked period in the Cold War, this under, if you will, no one had paid much attention to the difference between that early period and the later one when we had a long ice age of stability. And so I continued interviewing him and then started interviewing people who worked with him. And I realized that out of their experience, I could get at the history of this critical period in our era, which these men, during which, as I said, these men really saved us from nuclear holocaust.
Let's talk a little bit about Bernard Schriever's background. He was born in Germany, but in fact spent most of his childhood in Texas and graduated from A&M.
That's right. He's an A&M man. He came to this country when he was 6 years old from Germany. He and his younger brother, Gerhard, whose nickname is Gary, who's still with us at the age of 96. Their mother brought them over because their mother was a young German woman who had immigrated earlier to to New York City, where she worked for a German family that owned a pharmacy. Then she married a man, his father, who was a tall, handsome man like Bernard Shriver, and who was an engineer on the North German Lloyd Line. He was the engineer on a ship called, ironically, the George Washington. And she moved back to Germany after she married him and was living there in his home port. She had two boys with him. And then in August 1914, his passenger ship was trapped in New York Harbor. We were still neutral then, but the British weren't. And they couldn't leave the harbor because the ship would be seized by the Royal Navy. So his mother waited for a couple of years for the war to end, and when it didn't end, she got tired of waiting, and she put her boys on a ship out of Rotterdam. Holland was neutral during World War I. And Bernard Shriver, or Benny as he was nicknamed, by the Gulf writers in San Antonio, he remembered sailing north of, how they sailed north of Scotland because they couldn't sail through the English Channel in these enormous waves. They were almost they had a close scrape. They were boarded by a British inspection party, and his mother was afraid they would be taken off the ship because they were still German nationals. But fortunately, his younger brother had the mumps, and the Dutch crew warned the British boarding party, don't go near that cabin. There's a kid in there with the mumps, which is a very dangerous disease for older men. And they settled down in Texas because there was German settlement in the San Antonio area and back into the hill country where Lyndon Johnson's from. You have towns in there like New Braunfels and Fredericksburg, and there was less anti-German feeling there. And they also had relatives there. So they went to San Antonio, where his father was killed in an industrial accident a year after they arrived in 1918. But his mother raised her two boys as a housekeeper and also running a ham sandwich and soda pop stand next to the 12th green of the Brackenridge Park golf course in San Antonio.
Which turned out to be a fateful thing for young Bernard.
It did, because for a number of reasons. First of all, he became a champion golfer. He was Texas State amateur champion once, and then he was San Antonio champion 2 years in a row. He told me that golf really helped him later on in life in a number of ways. First of all, it's a very social game, and senior officers who wanted to play golf with a young man who was really good at it would ask to play golf with him. He was given a very good job, in fact, as a young officer. He joined the Army Air Corps in 1932. He went through flying school at Randolph and Kelly Field near San Antonio, right after he got out of Texas A&M. In fact, he was offered a job by one general who wanted to improve his golf game, who offered him a job as his aide, which Shriver took because it was a wonderful thing to get. You learned a lot working for a general. This general happened to be the commanding officer of the Air Corps down in the Panama Canal Zone. And one day he sent Shriver to the other side of the canal to greet his daughter, who was coming down from the United States, and they fell in love and married. Golf didn't hurt his career socially, and led ironically to his marriage. But he also told me that it helped him to learn to control himself, which was very useful given what he ended up doing. I mean, other people would lose their nerve when these rockets would blow up on the pad, but Shriver would always keep his cool. He said that golf had helped him that way, that because when you play a tournament, and in his days they played 36 holes in one day, you have to keep yourself under absolute iron control, because if you lose it, you're going to lose the tournament, because you can lose by one or two strokes. So you can't lose your nerve. You got to keep thinking and get control of yourself. If you're behind, you got to get yourself ahead. One sees that in Tiger Woods, but it really helped him.
And I guess Shriver was an exceptionally persuasive person, and it couldn't have hurt that he was having this experience with much more prestigious individuals at a young time in his life.
No, he was. First of all, he was always a very competent man. He was a very competent pilot. He was a persuasive man in the sense that later on, Well, he learned one of those early experiences. He was put in charge of a civilian conservation corps camp in New Mexico. This is back in the 30s during the Depression. It's called the CCC. There were young men who were recruited to do work, and they were paid. And there were military officers theoretically running the camps, but as he explained to me, you could not give these kids orders. They were not the military people, but you had to somehow get them to do the right thing. So he learned to get a group of boys who were capable of running the camp and let them run it. And he was very good at picking out people who could do things well and then giving them their head. So people liked to work for him. He also, being as responsive as he was and being as capable as he was, he impressed his superiors. I mean, his first commanding officer, when he arrived at Marchfield, California in 1933, was a man named Henry, nicknamed Hap because of his smile. Arnold, who was a lieutenant colonel then, who was the commander at the field, and he later on became commander-in-chief of all the air forces during World War II, and was the first general to receive and the only airman ever to receive 5 stars. He was a technological visionary, Arnold. He saw the great gift that civilian scientists had brought to the Air Force with radar and other high-tech improvements during World War II. And he wanted to preserve that. And so at the end of the war, he called Schriever, who had served with distinction out in the Pacific, to his office in the Pentagon and gave Schriever the task of continuing the relationship with civilian scientists in order to enhance air power and enhance the security of the country, therefore.
We are speaking this hour with Neil Sheehan. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who wrote A Bright Shining Lie. His newest book is called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Schriever and the Ultimate Weapon. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you are welcome to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Neil Sheehan. His new book is called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Schriever and the Ultimate Weapon. You can join our conversation by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Neil, let's step back for a moment and talk about about the weapons that helped us to prevail in the Second World War. We had made very effective strategic use of bomber planes in conventional missions and then, of course, also in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Much of that took place under the leadership of this guy, General Curtis LeMay.
That's right, and LeMay figures prominently in this story. He was the great bomber leader of World War II. He went over the edge in the Cold War. He was heading the Strategic Air Command. He became the model for General Jack D. Ripper in Stanley Kubrick's
Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. And he was Schriever's great opponent. What happened was the Strategic Air Command, which was built by LeMay, put together by LeMay, was our strategic deterrent in the early years of the Cold War. It was the bomber, the jet bomber, a fleet of jet bombers. But what LeMay didn't understand, and LeMay was wedded to the bomber because he was the bomber leader of World War II. He was emotionally wedded to it. He wasn't interested in anything else. He thought missiles were toys. I was given a briefing once on the ICBM, and he said, when you get through fooling with the effing firecrackers, come and see me. I mean, that was the attitude he had. Unfortunately for him, the technology was about to undercut the credibility of the bomber. because the Soviets had decided they were not going to try to compete with our bombers in building a fleet like ours. They were going to deliver their hydrogen bombs with intercontinental ballistic missiles, which, let me explain what an ICBM is. It's a rocket which is fired up into space. It has a warhead with a hydrogen bomb in it. It travels through space at 16,000 miles an hour for 6,000 to 7,000 miles, and then it comes down on its target. In the 1950s, there would only be 15 minutes warning of one of these things coming, and no way to stop it. There still is no way to stop them. And if the Russians built a fleet of these things ahead of time, they would before we had similar weapons that we could counter them with. They would undercut the credibility of the bomber because people would ask, "Well, how are you going to get the planes off the ground in 15 minutes?" You couldn't. You could do some things like airborne alert, but there was no way really to undercut the prevent the credibility from being undercut. And that was, Schriever saw this, and he saw that if they created a fleet of these things before we had our own, they would undercut the credibility of the deterrent, and you would get a period of instability in which you could easily have gotten adventurism by Soviet leaders, which would have triggered a nuclear holocaust, which would have wiped out the whole Northern Hemisphere.
What was President Eisenhower's initial position, especially given his leadership in the Second World War, on the relative merits of ICBMs as opposed to bombers?
Well, Ike was depending on the bomber because he hadn't thought about the ICBM. It really hadn't registered with him. And it was Schriever who brought it to his attention, Schriever and those who worked with him. He had two principal figures who were working with him. One was a man named Trevor Gardner, who was a Welsh immigrant. Now, it's interesting. Schriever's an immigrant from Germany. This man, Trevor Gardner, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development, was an immigrant from Wales, but a technological visionary like Schriever. And then the third was a man named John von Neumann, who was a Hungarian refugee from Nazism. He was a great mathematician and a mathematical physicist, probably the finest mind of the 20th century after Einstein. And they got the program going under Air Force Aegis in 1954. They started out in a vacant schoolhouse out in Inglewood, California, a vacant Roman Catholic schoolhouse. Inglewood's out by Los Angeles Airport. They got the program going, but the bureaucracy was so entrenched, they weren't getting anywhere fast. They weren't getting anything done fast enough to count. And every time Schriever discovered that he had to clear everything he did with 42 different agencies. It was an impossible situation. So they needed to get, number one, swift decision-making outside the bureaucracy. And number two, swift funding that nobody else could touch, something like what the Manhattan Project that built the atomic bomb during World War II had. Now, the only person who can give you that is the president.
So they needed an audience with him.
They had to get to Ike. But you just don't call him up on the telephone. Eisenhower was the president then. You just don't call the president up on the phone and say, "Well, you know, we'd like to come and brief you on our project." So they launched an intrigue. Schriever leaked classified reports on the problems he was having building these things to a senator named Henry Jackson. He was a hawk from Washington, liberal at home, hawk abroad. And Jackson held hearings on the basis of these classified reports and the Schriever's leaked to him. And also he called Gardner and von Neumann to the hearings. They testified about the problems they were having building these. And Jackson and another senator wrote Eisenhower a letter saying, "This is a terribly important thing. The destiny of the nation rides on it, and you ought to know, but you're not paying any attention to it. You ought to find out what's going on and get this thing going properly." And Ike immediately told the head of his National Security Council staff to schedule a briefing for him. What he didn't know was that the people who drafted the letter were Schriever, von Neumann, and Gardner. Senator Jackson had simply signed, and the other senator had simply signed the thing and sent it to Eisenhower. So The briefing was scheduled for July 28, 1955. Just before the briefing, they were instructed by the head of the National Security Council staff that they only had half an hour for the whole thing, and they were under no circumstances to mention to the president this letter he'd received, because it would be interpreted as an effort to pressure him. And Schriever wrote in his diary that night, "Termites in the woodwork." In other words, this guy who headed the National Security Council staff was not a friend of theirs. I mean, and imagine if he'd known that they were the drafters of the letter, the briefing would have been canceled. But the briefing wasn't. It was handled very, very deftly by the three of them. First Gardner scared the hell out. Now, this is a briefing at the White House of the National Security Council, which was a major body in those years. All of the members of the Joint Chiefs were present, all the cabinet secretaries, and head of the CIA, like Alan Dulles, and other important people, and the president. they led off with a briefing by Gardner, who scared the living bejesus out of everybody, informing them you'd only have 15 minutes warning and no way to stop this thing. And then von Neumann talked about the nuclear aspects of it. He scared the living hell out of everybody in the room. And then Schriever's role was to wrap it up and tell the president what the program was and what the problems, really tell the president what problems existed and how the problem, you know, how they had, what they needed to solve the problem. And Schriever was an impressive man. He was the handsomest general in the U.S. Air Force. He was 6 feet tall, very, very erect man. A New York Times reporter once compared him to Jimmy Stewart, but actually he was a better-looking man than Jimmy Stewart. And by this time, they had run an hour rather than the half hour they'd been given. And Schriever started his briefing, and then he had to give the president an opportunity to call a halt to this if the president wanted to, because they'd run so far over their time limit. So the room was filled with straight back wooden chairs, which everybody had to sit in, except for one big red leather armchair in the center of the front row for the president. By this point, Ike was no longer sitting back in the chair. He was sufficiently interested, so he was sitting forward on the edge of the chair. Mm-hmm. And Schriever turned to him and said, Mr. President, we have an 8-minute film of rocket engine testing we'd like to show you, testing done out in California at Santa Susana. And this was a colorful film of these rocket engines being fired. And it's 8 minutes. We'd like to show it to you at the end of the briefing if you'd like to see it. And Ike nodded at him, signifying, go ahead, young man. You've got all the time you want, you need. And so Eisenhower gave a very enthusiastic response. He immediately saw the importance of these and the need for them. He signed off on the program, giving them swift decision-making, swift funding, on September 13th. And then 10 days later, he had his first heart attack, and he was not able to hold a meeting of any kind for 2 months. It might have thrown the whole thing way off of schedule. It might have undercut the whole thing. They got in just under the wire. It was quite extraordinary.
And it's worth noting here that Eisenhower was rather fiscally conservative, typically, when it came to defense spending. He didn't want to spend any more than he had to keep the country safe.
You're absolutely correct. Eisenhower was the last president we've had who believed that military spending had to be kept in check in order to avoid damaging the economy. He was very, very adamant about that. But he saw as I said, Schriever was a technological visionary. He could see the relationship of these to strategy, to the security of the country. In other words, you had to create a stalemate, so you had to remove the possibility that the Soviets could pull off a surprise attack. And Eisenhower was constantly worried about this. He talked about a nuclear Pearl Harbor all the time, and he wanted to find a way to prevent it, and he saw immediately this would do it. And so he backed it right away, even though it was going to cost money, yes, but it was necessary money. Ike was perfectly willing to spend what he believed was necessary, but he was not adamant that he was not going to spend what was unnecessary. And having been, you know, a man, obviously, of his career, I mean, the leader of the Allied forces in Europe in World War II. He was somebody that, you know, no general could Buffalo Eisenhower. he was his own general.
Talk for a minute, if you would, Neil, about some of the technological challenges that existed at the time to building something like an ICBM.
Well, first of all, there was no aerospace industry in the country. There was an aircraft industry, but there was no aerospace industry. So Schriever and those who worked with him, like von Neumann and Gardner, had to create an aerospace industry of their own to get this thing built. The man who did much of the work in doing so was later became the R in TRW, Thompson Rainbow Wooldridge. His name was Simon Ramo. He was the chief engineer on the project and the chief scientist. And his job was to round up talent, mostly young men, and that's why they set the thing up in Southern California, where that kind of talent existed, that could overcome the technological problems involved in building this thing, because there were a lot of them. Let me give you an example. When you see a meteor come into the atmosphere, it's very colorful, that display of fireworks. What's happening is the meteor is burning up as it hits the friction of the atmosphere. Now, if you fired one of these things up into space, a hydrogen bomb and a cat with a warhead up into space, how are you going to bring it back down to the atmosphere without burning it up? They had to solve that problem. That was you know, one of the major technological problems they had to solve, and they did solve it. And later on, one of the benefits of this was they opened space for America, because the first astronauts rode on military missiles, and if you could bring the bomb back into Earth without burning it up, you could bring a man back. So John Glenn rode in a modified H-bomb capsule. He was first back into safely into the atmosphere. There were a lot, and this grew. It started out with about 35 people in the schoolhouse in California. They were alone later on as a schoolhouse gang, and it grew into hundreds of thousands of people in terms of the industries involved later on, and it transformed the aircraft industry into an aerospace industry.
Bigger than the Manhattan Project by the time all was said and done.
Yes, it was. It ended up being much bigger than the Manhattan Project because they built three generations of these missiles. The first two generations were liquid fuel missiles. They operated on the fuel was kerosene, and the burning agent was liquid oxygen. They were very difficult to get ready. That is to fuel, because you couldn't fuel them ahead of time. You could only fuel them when you were going to fire them, and they could barely make it under the 15-minute deadline. Then with Schriever's encouragement, he was pushing for this. A man named Edward Hall, Colonel Edward Hall, who was the Air Force guru of rocketry, he was the first man whom Schriever recruited for the program when he got the go-ahead in 54. And Colonel Hall built, with Schriever's encouragement, a missile called Minuteman. It's still on alert. There are 450 of them in the third generation still on alert. It was a solid fuel missile. It could be stored indefinitely and kept in ready to fire. The guidance system kept up and ready to go. And you could fire the thing within 1 minute after the orders were decoded. In one of these missile silos, you always had two young officers, both of whom were armed, so that if one started to do something crazy, the other one could shoot him. They each had a key, and they would, when the two keys were put in and turned simultaneously, 1 minute, 60 seconds later, this Minuteman would be out of the silo and gone. It's still true. There's still, as I said, 450 of them on the alert. So there was no way the Soviets could pull off a surprise attack, because you'd have at least 15 minutes warning. And these Minuteman missiles would be out of the silo and gone. And that created this nuclear stalemate, which later became known as mutual assured destruction, MAD, was the synonym. There was nothing MAD about it, because no Soviet leader with an ounce of sanity was going to attempt to knock out the United States as a surprise attack, because his own country would be destroyed.
So this was all sort of happening behind, out of public view until 1957, when suddenly the Soviets successfully launched Sputnik.
That's right, because, again, the Soviets, as Schreiber surmised, and they had very little hard evidence of it at first. It was a surmise on the part of Schreiber and also von Neumann, but Schreiber was the one who first realized the Soviets were going down the rocket road. In other words, they were not going to go the bomber route. The first Soviet missile that could reach the United States was something called the R-7, or Semyorka. It was a proto-ICBM. It could hit the United States, but you didn't know where in the United States the thing was going to hit. It was so inaccurate. It weighed 20 metric tons. It took 16 hours to fuel. But it had enormous power, and it had been built to carry a very heavy... He had, of course, two types of nuclear weapons. One was the original atomic bomb, the fission bomb, and then you had the hydrogen bomb, the fusion bomb.
Actually, let me have you stop right there, Neil, because we're going to take a quick break and we can continue this description in just a moment. Neil Sheehan is with us. His new book is called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Schriever and the Ultimate Weapon. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Neil Sheehan is my guest. His new book is called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Schriever and the Ultimate Weapon. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. And before the break, Neil, you were telling us about the differences between the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb.
Yeah, the atomic bomb is, of course, less powerful than the hydrogen bomb, which is much greater and much greater power. And the Soviet rocket had been built to carry a very heavy warhead because they hadn't gotten the hydrogen bomb at the time they started building this rocket. But it wasn't useful really as an ICBM, but it was very useful to put something like a satellite into orbit. And they put Sputnik up with it, which of course caused hysteria in this country. I mean, the fear that the Soviets were way ahead of us with technology. Technologically, they weren't. And then ultimately led to the charges of the missile gap, which didn't exist on our side. There was a missile gap, but by the time it occurred, the Soviets were suffering. There was a missile gap on the Soviet side. Schriever and his team had long surpassed the Soviets, and we had far more ICBMs than they had. As Schriever later on said, in maybe Texas fashion, we beat them to the draw.
President Kennedy campaigned on the problem of the missile gap. Was he misinformed, or did he deliberately use that to sort of drum up support for himself?
Originally, he was misinformed, but then he was briefed on the evidence that there was no missile gap because Schriever, again, and his team put up the first photo reconnaissance satellite, spy satellite, if you will, in August of 1960. The first day, the first run, after they got it going, took more footage of the Soviet Union than the U-2 had in all of its years, in all of its runs. And it was clear there was no missile gap because the missiles weren't there. Now, Kennedy was briefed on it. He personally stopped talking about a missile gap, but he didn't stop his followers from talking about it. After all, politics is a blood sport, and he wanted to win, and Richard Nixon suffered the consequences. The book is full of ironies like this because I write for the general reader. I don't write for the technical person, And I believe in recreating history, in writing a fast-paced narrative, and casting the book in novel form, which is hard to do and still remain true to history. You've got to be very careful you don't distort history to fit the form. But if you are true to it, you create a readable book that puts the reader back into the history of the past, which is what I've tried to do. One of the ironies, for instance, so we talked before about Minuteman missile, and the Minuteman missile that was built by Colonel Edward Hall, the Air Force guru of rocketry whom Schriever recruited. Well, Edward Hall's younger brother was a man named Theodore Hall. During the Second World War, he was a physics protege at Harvard. During the Second World War, he was recruited to work at Los Alamos, and he worked in the most sensitive area of the bomb work. He was a communist. He'd been a member of one of the few Harvard students who joined the Communist Society at Harvard, where he had been a physics protege. He volunteered to be a spy for the Soviet Union, and he was one of the two most important Soviet spies at Los Alamos. He and a German physicist named Klaus Fuchs, whom the Brits sent over, who was also a communist. Now, the Army Counterintelligence Corps, which was responsible for keeping spies out of Los Alamos, were a bunch of Keystone cops. They had the whole laboratory surrounded with a barbed wire, with a big, tall fence, with guarded watchtowers. They had agents in all the bars and the hotels and God knows, maybe the bordellos in the Santa Fe area. But they never checked the backgrounds of anybody that let in the gate.
It didn't occur to them that one of their own could be dirty.
No. Well, they were focused on Oppenheimer, who had mainly through his wife left-wing connections. But Oppenheimer was absolutely loyal, and was managing the project and was totally loyal. Was a fine American. They never looked below at other people coming in, because if you looked into the backgrounds of Klaus Fuchs, for example, whom the Brits sent over, you'd see immediately that he was a German communist who refugeed out because the Nazis would have killed him, and who was involved in communist activities in Britain before he was sent over here. If you looked in the background of Theodore Hall, you'd see he was one of the few Harvard students who joined the Communist Party. But they never looked into people's backgrounds. They'd simply, that is the backgrounds of people they let in the gate. All the security was inside. So it was a real Keystone Cop situation. At one point, the Soviet spy center, which was in the Soviet consulate in New York, sent out a courier, a woman named Lana Cohen, who later became a famous Soviet spy, to pick up information Theodore Hall was passing them. And she met with Hall in Santa Fe, rendezvoused with him, and he handed her a sheaf of notepaper with very important information about the bomb. And she went back to her hotel, packed her bag, and headed for the train station to get to New York to turn this over to the Soviet spies at the consulate there. When she got to the train station, she noticed that, wow, they were searching the handbags of the ladies and their suitcases. They were searching the bags of everybody who got on the train. What to do? So she waited till just before the train was due to leave. She took the notes from Hall with the atomic bomb information on it and put them under some Kleenex in a Kleenex box she had. Went out to the train. Made believe she was put the Kleenex box under her arm. Went out to the train. Made believe she was the hapless, helpless female fumbling with the zipper on her pocketbook. Then stopped. Handed the Kleenex box to one of the security men, opened her pocketbook, handed it to another one, then they opened her suitcase, they searched both, fine, nothing there. She had the wit not to ask for that Kleenex box back, knowing that in those days gallant men were more gallant toward women than they are now, and he would probably hand it to her. So she just picked up her handbag and her suitcase and headed for the train. The security man said, "Madam, you forgot your Kleenex." And he handed her the box of Kleenex with all the top secret information in it. The book's got a lot of ironies like this in it, because it was quite an extraordinary thing. Quite extraordinary things went on.
Neil Sheehan is my guest. The new book is called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War. You can join us at 800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Chris in Dallas. Hey, Chris.
Hi there.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Neil, it's a pleasure to speak to you. I was a naval intercept voice operator, and part of the training that we received was the story of Eisenhower blabbing during the Francis Gary Powers spy plane shoot down that tipped the Russian intelligence services off to us reading the Russian code and having the rotations of all of their transmissions, certain military transmissions, a year's worth of work that was destroyed by Eisenhower's slip of the lip, so to speak. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with that, but there have been many instances of it. For instance, in the case of this young spy, Theodore Hall, whose brother, by the way, who developed Minuteman, I mean, this is the irony of this, the older brother stymieing the Soviets and the younger brother helping them, didn't know anything about his younger brother activities. And it was never brought to his attention because the Army codebreakers didn't want the Soviets to know they'd broken the code that had been used by the KGB at the station in New York. So the younger brother was never prosecuted.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We should stress this point here that although he needed it to work perfectly, Schriever never intended to actually have to deploy these weapons of mass destruction.
That's absolutely the case. Schriever emphasized over and over again that the ICBM was the first weapon in the history of humankind that was being built not to be used in war, but to deter war. Now, you had to make you had to prove that it was a weapon that would work. You actually had to deploy it in silos. But the intention was never to fire it, as he said, never to fire it in anger, but to deter war. And it worked. I mean, these guys were genuine American heroes. We're talking here now because they created this nuclear stalemate, which bought time, which was critical in this. You could not solve the problems of the Cold War, like the division of Germany, so long as the Soviet Union existed. You had to wait for the Soviet Union to collapse before you could solve those problems. No one realized it was going to collapse when it did. No one in the West, I don't think, realized it was going to collapse ahead of time at the time it did. But nevertheless, time was critical. You couldn't act ahead of time because so long as the Soviet Union existed, they were going to block you from solving these problems of the Cold War.
Let's move into the present a little bit. You mentioned that the United States, at this moment, has 450 Minuteman missiles at the ready. I want to talk about last week when President Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize. One of the reasons the committee gave for awarding it to him was his stated objective to eliminate nuclear weapons from the world or to work for that. Do you think the prize will sort of fortify that commitment in his mind?
I think it will fortify his intention to reduce the number of nuclear weapons we have. He's already moved down that road, because the Russians are moving down that road with us. The relationship is quite different, obviously, from the Cold War years. And he and President Medvedev reached an agreement, if I'm correct, not most recently, to reduce the number of missiles on alert by about a quarter. And there have been a series of arms reductions under George Bush that occurred as well. And I think it's going to continue till they get down to the point where they've got a minimum deterrent. Eliminating nuclear weapons entirely is going to be a very difficult thing because the technology is out there. It's not a secret anymore. And so many countries have got nuclear weapons now. You have Pakistan, you've got India, you've got Iran probably on the way to building a bomb, you've got the North Koreans. Israel has dozens of nuclear weapons and the capacity to deliver them. And, of course, don't forget Britain and France, both of which have nuclear weapons, and their deterrent is the missile-launching submarine. So that it's going to be very difficult to get rid of nuclear weapons entirely, but you can get it down to a minimum.
How enthusiastic, when he was still alive, was General Schriever about your interest in telling his story?
Oh, he was a very deliberate man. Benny was his nickname. It was given to him by the golf writers in San Antonio. because they wanted a snappier name than Bernard for their headline. So they nicknamed him Benny, and it stuck. He was the kind of man who he wanted to be sure of things, and it took a number of interviews before he decided I was the guy. And he asked questions about me of friends of his, other called an Air Force historian who would know my work, wanted to know what kind of a historian I was, and he was very. And then he made up his mind I was the guy to tell his story, their story, not just his but their story. And he knew I was telling it through him. So he completely cooperated with me. I told him, General, you've got to give me your entire military record, which he didn't have. I need to see all of your efficiency reports. I need to know what your superiors thought of you. I need your personal diary, the diary of which was very important to me, the diary of that he kept during the project. I need, and he sat me down. I would go to, he invited me to go to their reunions, which I did. They would have a reunion every year of what they call the old timers, the original people originally involved. And he told all of these men, look, this guy's going to interview you. And I went all over the country interviewing them. I interviewed 120 people altogether, and talked to him, tell him the truth. I couldn't ask for better cooperation. He sat me down one night during one reunion, and he said, look, I know I'm not going to live to see this book published, but do it right. It was a very moving, it was very moving to have that kind of trust put in you by someone who was a very distinguished and man of high patriotism, because he was immensely grateful to this country for what it had done for him. I mean, he had a very good youth growing up down there in San Antonio, very exciting youth, but he was deeply grateful to the United States. They renamed an air base in his honor while he was still alive. It's now Schriever Air Force Base out in Colorado, near Colorado Springs.
Neil Sheehan, I'm so sorry we're out of time. Neil Sheehan's new book is called A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Schriever and the Ultimate Weapon. Neil, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
It's 12:59. We are your source for NPR News. This is KERA 90.1 Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, streaming at KERA.org. Also, K261 CW 100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. Later today on All Things Considered, back in February, the federal stimulus program became law, and critics said the $787 billion in aid was slow to make its way to the local level. Now there are some signs of progress around the country. An update on federal stimulus funding this afternoon starting at 4 on KERA 90.1. It's 1 o'clock. Think continues on KERA 90.1.
Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, an improbable journey to the heart of white America. My guest will be Demos fellow Rich Benjamin, who spent 2 years living in what he calls whitetopias around the U.S., fast-growing communities made up almost entirely of European Americans who have left more diverse communities hoping to feel safer in their neighborhoods. We'll talk to Benjamin about why these boomtowns appeal to their residents, how they might affect the fabric of America, and how he, an African-American journalist, was treated by his whitetopian neighbors. Our conversation begins after the news from National Public Radio.